This is Melissa, and it is the 1st of February, 2026. I hope that you are all doing well, and that if it's winter where you are, it is not too bad, not too harsh. Here, it was freezing from last Friday. I was snowed in, iced in from Friday until really Wednesday morning before I could go anywhere. And I ventured out and realized that it was unsafe. So I did make it to the tax office on Thursday, me and everybody else in the county. So I was waiting a good nearly 3 hours to get to the window to pay the bill. And I am so thankful to you for helping me do this. I said, if you've been thinking about ordering, if you can donate at this time, this is going to be very helpful to me. And you came through, and I really appreciate it. Thank you. So in that long wait, I was able to strike up a few conversations with people who were sitting near me. And there was one conversation that I had that was kind of fun, where we all agreed that we were not at the tax office to pay our tax bill, but we were waiting to see the mafia overlord to pay tribute, because that's really what it felt like. And, you know, it's kind of good in a misery loves company way to, and, you know, to get the confirmation that other people realize what a disgusting scam system that we live under and what a burden it is that we're put through. So that being able to connect to other people made the wait go a little bit more quickly. And I, again, thank you. I really appreciate it. So it's still pretty cold here, but there's no precipitation. They said that we were going to have more ice and snow yesterday, but that didn't happen. So it's just freezing temperatures. My plants have been bagged up for over a week now. So hopefully at least some of them survived. I also wanted to tell you that we concluded the coverage of Waiting for the Miracle. So this has been such a big project there on Telegram at the CTTM Book Club, especially for those who are more hands-on, the two administrators of the channel, and, you know, everyone who also pitched in on covering material. It has been a real amazing endeavor. And we discussed there yesterday that it's really 2 years that we have been at that, because it was in January of 2024 that we embarked on Tragedy and Hope. And that took us until about March of 2025. And then we started on Waiting for the Miracle in May of last year. And I also started the Substack as a place to put the videos for the book club. And that Substack has kind of morphed into an interesting thing too, because some of the people from the book club have contributed things there. Darren wrote a couple of articles for it, and Tartan Tinker, G&G have done quite a lot, quite a few articles and time capsules, and it's been fun to see that grow in this way. And so I'm looking forward to keeping that going. And we have discussed that we will continue with the Cutting Through books, but we all need a break. Speaking for myself, I really need a break. So that will be nice. And it should time out, I think, with the reprint of the Cutting Through books. And those should be ready to go to the printer in about a week's time. Derek is finishing up the cover art for that, and it looks beautiful so far. And Ula is inputting the last round of the corrections on typos, and then there's a bit of work that's involved. Any change changes the whole text of the book, and so she's carefully going over that. But I am hopeful, fingers crossed, that we could be going to the printer, oh, I don't want to say, but really, really soon, I think. And so as far as book club goes, I think that we are hoping that we can have an option for people to have the reprint before we start studying that. So this is what is going on there. So that is book club and Substack and waiting for the miracle. And so, okay, what's next? My taxes are paid. The weather is manageable. I feel like I'm missing something, but let's get to the Redux here. This is from November 15, 2007, and it will be a good follow-up for those who were in the book club talking about the last two interviews of Waiting for the Miracle. We got into Theosophy. So this Redux, Robo Roaches and New Age Coaches. Motto, hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil, equals state of denial. Alan talks about channelers and the New Age and Madame Blavatsky, Annie Besant, Alice Bailey, Theosophy, Mysticism, Obelisks in the Christian Church, the Eye of Ra, what does it all mean? So it's the creation of what Alan says is modern mythology for the New Age, for the age that we're going into now. And as I was looking at some of the current events and the current players in current events, the thing that struck me was how intertwined it all is. You can look at it and see it as like a kaleidoscope, and over here you've got religion, and over there you've got politics, and a little bit further you have science, and then beyond that you have money and economies and banking and military and wars. But when you start to look at it closely, and it does not matter what age in history that you pick, you see these connections, and they don't always come together in your mind as like, what am I seeing? What is this? But the connections are there. And sometimes people will say to you, oh, you're reaching. That's a real stretch there. But what are we doing? At the end of the day, we're just putting it together for ourselves. What makes sense to us, and how do we make sense of the world that we live in? But last week on the Redux that I put up, Alan Watt said, hey, what are we looking at? Gangsters. And when I do the kind of digging around that I like to do with the characters who are mentioned, you know, who's the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, and what's he about? Who just got nominated to run the Federal Reserve, and what's that about? And you see these family connections, and you see that you know, they knew each other going back a generation, going back two generations, and oh, they were a member of the Skull and Bones, and they worked for this banking outfit, and you see gangsters. It comes to the point where it's kind of hard to see it any other way, unless you're going to go supernatural and see them as a bunch of entities, which I don't have a problem with. But gangsters, that's easy. So in the news this week, what do we have? Do we have a little bit of a lull? Are we hearing a lull? That You know, we've got ships that are headed to Iran, but right now they probably won't have to do anything because they're negotiating. And Trump says, you know, it's looking good, we're negotiating. And Greenland, same thing, you know, lots of hot air, and we're gonna take it, we're gonna take it by force, we're gonna put tariffs on it, and then that kind of calms down. But behind the scenes, you see these characters like somebody like Scott Bessent, who is saying about Iran, they're going to cave. You know, we're starving them out. We're putting incredible financial heat on them, and they're collapsing. And this he said last month. Well, recently he said that they're all fleeing like rats from a ship, I think is how he described it. His department has tracked the wiring of tens of millions of dollars out of the country by Iranian leaders. There's this quote, "We're now seeing the rats fleeing the ship. We are tracing these assets, and they will not be able to keep them." Well, of course they won't be able to keep them, because the other gangsters are coming in to take over the money that they're fleeing with. This is how it's done. So who is Scott Bessent? I mentioned last week that Scott Bessent and Kevin Warsh were on the short list for the appointment of heading up the Federal Reserve. And just a day or two ago, Trump has made that shortlist shorter by making his nomination for Kevin Warsh. So let's talk about who didn't get that nomination, and that's Bessent. He is, as a reminder, the current U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. I mentioned that he sold his pink palace before he took over his job. He is a graduate of Yale University, political science. He is the first openly gay person to lead the U.S. Treasury Department and the second openly gay U.S. Senate-confirmed cabinet secretary. Now, when you look into news coverage on Bessent, you'll find part of the, what do they call that? Is it kayfabe, I think, at wrestling. We'll just say wrestling. Because there's all kinds of trash talking that they get up to. Like at the World Economic Forum in Davos, he mocked Gavin Newsom, California's governor, during the recent World Economic Forum gathering in Davos. He said that Newsom was economically illiterate, and he mocked him as Patrick Bateman meets Sparkle Beach Ken. Now, if this doesn't sound like catfighting talk, who's Patrick Bateman? He was a fictional character from American Psycho. So he's a fictional psycho boy meets a Ken doll. This is the kind of silly trash talk that we're given to follow, you know, with wrestling. What's a little bit more to know about Scott Bessent? Well, he considered Donald Trump's recently deceased younger brother to be one of his best friends, and that particular Trump's ex-wife is the godmother of one of his children delivered by surrogate. His uncle was John Jenrette, who was a representative, a congressman, way back in the 70s and the 80s. And he is famous for having a couple of scandals. Allegedly, he had sex with his wife behind a pillar on the steps of the Capitol building during a late-night break of a session of Congress. This led to a comedy troupe naming themselves Capitol Steps. That ex-wife later posed nude in Playboy. and wrote a tell-all memoir. So that's Scott Bessent's uncle. Scott Bessent went to Yale, but I mentioned earlier, probably last year, that he was not Skull and Bones, but he belonged to another organization that was called the Wolf's Head Society. And Wolf's Head, supposedly, if you look at the history of it, it started as a kind of reaction to the fact that Skull and Bones controlled the landscape, and so it was kind of a competing secret society. But I wondered how they got the name Wolf's Head, and their logo, their pin that you receive, it's a stylized wolf's head on top of an inverted ankh. Now, the ankh is the Egyptian hieroglyph that they sometimes call it the Egyptian cross, or it's sometimes called the key of life. And it says that this is about the Wolf's Head Society. It says it represents, this inverted ankh, the eternal life. Eternal life is symbolized rather than death. And it's like, well, how could that be? If the symbol right side up represents life, then how could inverted it also represent life? But I wondered about I'll put up an image there. This will be a sparsely illustrated video because I won't have a lot of time for it. But I'll put up an image there of the ankh and also of the pin for the Wolf's Head Society. And I kept digging a little bit. And this is what Manly P. Hall had to say about a wolf. What the wolf might symbolize. He said the wolf is usually associated with the principle of evil because of the mournful discordance of its howl and the viciousness of its nature. In Scandinavian mythology, the Fenris wolf was one of the sons of Loki, the infernal god of the fires. With the temple of Asgard in flames about them, the gods, under the command of Odin, fought their last great battle against the chaotic forces of evil. With frothing jowls, the Fenris wolf devoured Odin, the father of the gods, and thus destroyed the Odinic universe. Here, the Fenris wolf represents those mindless powers of nature that overthrew the primitive creation. So that's one possible way of seeing the wolf. You also have you've got the lone wolf idea, but more often what you have when you see a wolf is that it runs in a pack and there is loyalty and strength in the pack. So when I look at the inverted ankh of a secret society with a wolf head on top, and I see the kind of people who have been involved in the wolf head society, I would incline towards seeing it as a pack of evil people. So there have been a few high-profile members of the Wolf Heads Society down through time, including General Douglas MacArthur of World War II fame. And Scott Bessent has also participated in dialogue. Now, dialogue is described as a secretive, invitation-only social club founded by Peter Thiel and Auron Hoffman. It's compared to Bilderberg and the World Economic Forum. The organization was founded by Peter Thiel and Auron Hoffman. It maintains a low public profile. It has no website that is accessible to the public. It has no disclosed membership. It's described as a closed-door meeting that brings together executives, elected officials, and academics. In 2025, Dialogue purchased land in the Washington, D.C. area for a planned campus. Participants from past events have included Rima Alsaad, Scott Bessent, Cory Booker, Sophia Bush, Ted Cruz, Tulsi Gabbard, Richard Haass, that's CFR, Reid Hoffman, Garry Kasparov, Jared Kushner, Elon Musk, Larry Summers, Eric Schmidt, Rick Warren. Okay, so those last two names, just so that you can get an idea of who hangs out at this super secretive dialogue. Eric Schmidt of Google fame. Rick Warren, a Baptist megachurch pastor. Again, I just want to say the word gang. So I think Tartan Tinker plans on writing something more about Annie Besant and theosophy. So I am going to leave some of the heavy lifting to him on that project. But Alan has said that the name Besant means flag, that it comes from the French word Bossant. And it was the war flag of the Knights Templar. So Bossant, Knights Templar war flag. But if you look up Besant, Scott's last name, very close, you get a complementary meaning, I think. It's very important what people are named, Alan Watt would always say. So it's a Middle English word, Besant or Besand, which referred to a gold coin first minted in Byzantium, which is modern-day Istanbul. The term itself comes from the Latin Byzantius, meaning a gold coin named after the city of Byzantium. The name was likely used as an occupational surname for someone who worked as a coiner, moneyer, or merchant. The surname may also have been a nickname for wealthy or prosperous individual given the association with valuable gold coinage. Over time, the name evolved with various spellings such as Besant, B-E-S-A-N-T, B-E-S-S-A-N-T, B-E-Z-Z-A-N-T, B-E-C-E-N-T. So, a man whose name means gold coin, whose bestie friend is Robert Trump. Oh, and he hangs out with King Charles III. Is the current Secretary of the Treasury, who sold his pink palace for something like $20 million. That is Besant. But who did get the appointment to the Federal Reserve? Well, it went to someone that I also mentioned last week, who is the son-in-law of Robert Lauder. And I'm going to post the War Paint article, Not Sure article, again, because I was bemoaning the fact in book club that I've only had an opportunity to write one piece and going on 3 months now because I've been so busy, and this is the piece, so you'll have to read it over and over again until I write something new. This is from the BBC. Will Trump's pick to lead U.S. Central Bank get him the change he wants? Yeah, like really, Donald Trump wants this, you know, kayfabe. It's totally wrestling. Donald Trump has been calling for change at the U.S. Central Bank. Now, with Jerome Powell's term as Federal Reserve Chairman poised to end in May, he could be about to get his wish. On Friday, the U.S. President announced Kevin Warsh, a conservative whom he had passed over for the post, to his regret, during his first term, as his choice to replace Powell. Warsh, he said, now this is interesting. Warsh is central casting, and he will never let you down. If you think about it, when you hear the words central casting, you hear someone who looks the part, or fits the part. So that was an interesting choice of words there. Warsh is central casting and he will never let you down, Trump declared on social media as he announced the decision. The irony of the choice was lost on no one. Warsh has made his name as a supporter of higher interest rates, a reputation he has tried to shed in recent opinion articles and media appearances. It's a position that would seem to put him at odds with Trump, a self-described low interest rate guy, who has criticized Powell for not cutting interest rates quickly enough and who has made no secret that his choice to lead the Fed should be on board with his views. It remains to be seen whether Warsh's selection will lead to the bank Trump wants. All right, I'll post that. Kevin Warsh is the son-in-law of Robert Lauder. And Robert Lauder is the billionaire who's got interests and stakes in Greenland. And he is also the current president of the World Jewish Congress, which is a very important organization. Now, just a wee bit more on Kevin Warsh. Kevin Maxwell Warsh is an American financier and bank executive, this is straight out of Wiki here, who served as a member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors from 2006 to 2011. During and in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, Warsh acted as the central bank's primary liaison to Wall Street and served as the Federal Reserve's representative to the Group of 20, G20, and as the board's emissary to the emerging and advanced economies in Asia. He was special assistant, Boy, they have such long titles. It's so impressive, these gangsters. Why don't they just call him Gangster 1, 2, 3, and 4? You know, it has to look real. So he was the special assistant to the president for economic policy and executive secretary of the White House National Economic Council under President George W. Bush. Would it not be easier to say he's, gangster number 17 down the list? He is currently the Shepherd Family Distinguished Visiting Fellow in Economics at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, a scholar and lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, a member of the Group of 30. Well, hey, what's the Group of 30? I am going to tell you. The Group of 30, often abbreviated to G30, was started as an initiative in 1978 by the Rockefeller Foundation. And this had something to do, I'll tell you, and if you're interested, you can knock yourself out because it was really boring to me. But it was started because of some international currency problems that had to do with something called the balance of payment crisis, which America had to face in the early 1960s. But it's still on the go, and it has to do with foreign exchange market, capital markets, all the different international financial institutions, central banks, and their supervision. So it's really, really important. And he was a member of that. A member of the panel of economic advisors to the Congressional Budget Office, and a former steering committee member of the Bilderberg Group. All right. Looking like a gangster to me. He worked for Morgan Stanley in New York City, rising to executive director of the company's mergers and acquisitions. You know, it just reminded me in reading this little bit of a bio that I forgot a key kind of thing about Scott Bessent that I thought was noteworthy. And this had to do with his very first job after college, Brown Brothers Harriman. Brown Brothers Harriman is the oldest and one of the largest private investment banks in the United States. In 1931, the merger of Brown Brothers and Company, founded 1818, and Harriman Brothers formed the current BBH. Brown Brothers Harriman is also notable for the number of influential American politicians, government appointees, and cabinet members who have worked at the company, such as W. Averill Harriman, Prescott Bush, Robert A. Lovett, Richard W. Fisher, Robert Roussa, Alan Greenspan, and Scott Bessent. Now, Alan Watt has talked to us quite a bit about the connections there with Averill Harriman and Prescott Bush, but he summed it up nicely last week when he said we're looking at gangsters. So this is from page 5 of Cutting Through Volume 2. History is presented to every generation as a mass of unrelated incidents. The front groups we call governments, we are told, simply pass laws as we, the most advanced species ever existing, stumble along in time. Whenever someone comes across old, dry, boring books from the last few centuries outlining world plans for humanity, our education and conditioning kicks in. We then put it into the category of coincidence theory. So that was just a wee tiny bit of some coincidences. Just one more quick thing. This was actually a two-part, just under two-hour talk that Alan gave as an installment of Cutting Through the Matrix for WTPRN. And I am only playing for you the first 49, 50 minutes of that. And the other half I will link to, and I will also link to the transcript for both hours. Thank you.
Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix. On November the 15th, 2007, newcomers should always check into cuttingthroughthematrix.com for lots of downloadable material on the histories of this old world of ours. It's seen so much chaos and we're going through the next phase of chaos as they bring out the new age. Now, for those who suddenly wake up because they've been personally affected by the changes that are occurring more rapidly today, mainly in the pocketbook or the loser jobs, and plants close down, or the competition buys out their company and throws them on the street, the workers generally don't know what's really going on, and they're told by the mainstream media that they shouldn't look for a job for life. It's been going on for about 20 years now. When they started this hype, you'll have maybe 10, 15 jobs in your lifetime, and you're supposed to just get used to it. And the ground in circles looking for answers, and those who manage to get back into companies and businesses and corporations stop right there. Once they get employed again, they're back into the rat race. They're shuffling hard for money, and they're hustling away to keep afloat and to keep their mortgages going or their rents going or families going. And it's not an easy task. So therefore, it's easy for them when they start to wake up to fall into the other trap, which has been laid out by the same big boys who run the world. And that's the trap of thinking that somehow, it can't be human beings that run this world. It must be something alien to them. And that comes quite naturally because, you see, you've already swallowed the world as it's been presented to you. And the thought that there could be people who are so well connected and organized, that run the world so incredibly detailed in their mythology, is a hard thing to grasp. So it's either to jump off into the paranormal or into aliens or whatever. rather than accept the basic truth. And part of the reason for that is because we have been given a complete fake history, a fake reality, in fact. And it's so easy then to jump into what must be something else, because I'm so clever, how could I have been fooled my whole life? So you fall into the trap of it must be something other than human. In a sense it is, in that it's psychopathic in structure, and that can be verified if you want to look into the pathologies of psychopathy. It's not hard to find. And you find these people crave power all down through the ages. Now, they give us the old histories of ancient tyrants, and the most recent one we're always given is Adolf Hitler. But there's been many more since even Hitler, and they're born in every generation. And they're born mainly in the powerful families, at least the ones we see who emerge, the ones who are lucky enough to be born into these wealthy, powerful families. They take over from their parents, and they become dynasties, as we see in politics, especially in the U.S. In Britain, they're more careful to hide their names, often taking the maiden name for the males even. But they're dynasties that run the world, and they run it through institutions that go up in a pyramid-type structure, until you have the big boys at the top, and the royal families even of Europe, and beneath them you have this Royal Institute of International Affairs, which claims, even though it's a royal charter, to exist as an institution, and it's a legal term, institution, like a public institution. It's kind of there to serve a purpose for the public, but not on behalf of the public. It's chartered by royalty. And they're the guys who set up the League of Nations, and then they set up the United Nations. And their goal has always been a world system, a global system, based on the one system that stemmed from the elite of, say, London, England, for instance. And they'll stand for no other cultures standing in their way, no ulterior alternative. Methods or cultures will be allowed to coexist with them. A standardization process, if you like. And from there, they set up the Council for Pacific Relations. That was a branch that has dealt for about 70 years with the Far East in Australia and New Zealand. And their job was to bring in that group under a big trading bloc for the future, which is here now. And they set up the Council on Foreign Relations, the American branch, that deals mainly with the Americas. And they're bringing everything together. Now, people should look into their own website, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and you'll see they also have members-only pages where they get they give a public description of themselves, but they have a membership-only column there as well, because those who have memberships have their own passwords and they get in to the different multifarious sites they have, incredible amount of sites that they have, and all the organizations that run off of them. That's the tree of life, you might say, because it's got branches going into every facet of society. And this was started up officially, that is, by the combination of the Rhodes Foundation. Cecil Rhodes was given a charter to start up his own little private, almost the Blackwater of his day, a private sort of organization that would take over a good part of Africa, especially the mineral rights, the gold and diamond rights of it, to accumulate the wealth, but also to start wars and get to the Boers, the Dutch, out of South Africa. And they did it by staging a raid on the Boers settlements, claiming it happened the other way around. They even employed a woman reporter who told the British people that the Boers had attacked the British, so what could Britain do, poor soul? It had to go and defend English settlers, and that's how the Boer War started. It was started by a private company doing a raid into South Africa and then employing reporters to lie to the British public and giving the British government an excuse to do what they always wanted to do in the first place. And that's how history is made, you see. And that's official, that's now declared, it's on the open in the even more modern history books. But they eventually merged with the Lord Alfred Milner Round Table Society, another high elite organization made up of aristocracy, and they became the Royal Institute of International Affairs, with the goal of creating a system of free trade but not just free trade. It sounds so wonderful, free trade. But really, it was to limit trade. It was for big corporations, which they would found themselves, remembering that Britain was the premier organization for actually founding world corporations, beginning with the British East India Company. That was all funded by the royal families of Europe, and the shareholders were also the same people. Ordinary people couldn't get shares in it at all. And they ran the opium trades and all the other nefarious types of drug trades, which they comically called spices, the spice wars. So their goal then was to bring in a British-type system, and they created what they also called the Anglo-American Establishment. A very good book was put out by Professor Carol Quigley on this topic and the connections to interrelated families of both Britain and the United States, with this particular goal in mind of world government, and how they, through corporations and foundations working in tandem, would eventually control the world, using this London-based system as the foundation, this type of culture that exists within the elite of the aristocracy. And have been behind wars from the very beginning. As I say, the first war they had, they started off the Boer War, and they take credit for that too. They were the ones who started it with this private little group of Cecil Rhodes. That's how wars are started, and that's how you get the desired effect, which is really to get a synthesis, because out of every war and conflict, you have treaties made where the victor generally takes the spoils, but you always find too, and this is known in sociology and in political science, the high bureaucracy of the defeated side, because they live so well and so high on the hog generally, merge with the bureaucracies of the victors, and they become one. And that's happened all the way back to ancient Egypt even. The same thing happened with invading armies in Egypt, and you always found after about 20 years or even less, the bureaucracies of the invading armies, their governmental type system structure would merge with the Egyptians, and it all become one. And they grow and create a bigger empire from that union. It didn't matter who won and who lost, because amongst elite, they never lose, you see. And often you find they're related anyway, first cousins and sometimes even brothers. The history of England alone will prove that point. And you find from Queen Elizabeth I's court onwards, they were more open with an agenda. We tend to look at the Middle Ages and think they were pretty backwards and living so primitively, and nothing can be further from the truth for the wealthy elite. They lived very, very well. Even by today's standards, lived at a much higher standard than the average person can imagine. Going back to ancient Rome, don't forget they had undergrounds water, hot water for central heating, going around their big palaces. You go back even further into the Minoan society, and we know that from little islands that are left from a huge island that sunk in the Aegean Sea, where Terra is now. Terra, with all of its frescoes and its wonderful living in the azure seas, had plumbing to all the different houses that were built in it, plumbing, hot water as well. So they lived very well indeed. And you go back even further to the Harappan civilization, the precursor of Sumer, and my goodness, you find those guys, rich, rich merchants too, that ran more ancient trade routes all the way from the Middle East right through to China, also had indoor showers. Well, indoor showers, eh? And we think they're so modern. I bet they paid a lot less for it then as they do today. So in the Middle Ages, going back to Queen Elizabeth I's court, they were much more open with their agenda when they declared it would be a British or Brightish, B-R-Y-tish empire. That's what they called it. And John Dee was the man who proposed it to Queen Elizabeth I. And it would be based on free trade. And those countries that would adopt the British system would be eventually called a commonwealth, because you held the wealth of the commoners, the commonwealth, you see. And at the same time, if they would adopt the same parliamentary type system of aristocracy running over with the House of Lords and all the rest of it, then they would be given a form of most favored nations, a trading establishment. 100-year-old plans are nothing at all. 400-year-old plans are nothing at all to fulfill if you have the foundations. And as Carl Quigley said, foundations exist and last longer than any single person. They employ, as they retire, older members, they employ new members, and they take over with the agenda and the mandate, and they can fulfill whatever they project in the future. And that's how they pull all of this off, is by planning, a careful selection of their members, and unlimited wealth to hire think tanks for these institutions to make sure that they can plan a future, look at all the reactions from the public in that future, and even set up leaders to sway the public off in a different direction. And that's all before they've made the first move on the chessboard. So you plan everything like a strategy in war way ahead of time, and then gradually you pull it off. And for those who wake up, they're suddenly stunned because they have no idea. They think that democracy really exists. They really do. They really think there's been such a thing as democracy, which has been the main front cover for this whole agenda all of this time. And then they find out suddenly, no, all these institutions that they're given for the public really don't work, or they're not there at all, or there's no real justice. So they go off into outer space thinking it must be aliens, and that's why big boys are funded by the Futurist Society to put that idea in your mind. And then you run around in circles for the rest of your life buying lots and lots of books and talking about Zeta Reticuli and visiting channelers and all this rubbish, and you become very, very poor, very confused indeed, and you'll never get anywhere near the truth. You're in la-la land. The New Age movement was also created by the big foundations. Look into the histories, for instance, of Madame Blavatsky, who was to kick off a form of Freemasonry, even though Pike and Mackay, who was historian for Freemasonry, said these were side degrees. They're not real true degrees because they only give men the high degrees. But it was to fool women into joining this, what they thought was an occult mystic organization, because they had to get the middle class female population on board, so they gave them what they called theosophy. And Blavatsky was put out there as the founder. She was primarily an actress. Her sister herself wrote a book about it, saying she'd been acting since she was a child and telling stories. And she did her job very well. And she was getting backing by the media that was also owned by the same aristocracy that pushed her. You always give religions for the public. You give mysticism to the public, and you keep them mystified forever. And the best way of discrediting true information, which is called intelligence, is to grab that same intelligence, mix it with fantasy, and offer it to the public, who will often run with it. And those who are still giving out the basic intelligence are then poo-pooed by people who've heard all the nonsense. I'll be back with more after the following messages. Hi. I'm Alan Watt, back with Cutting Through the Matrix, and just taking some of the veils away to show you how very, very wealthy people who run the money system of the world, the trick is to get the public to believe what wealth is. They say this is wealth, and so you believe it and you use it for currency. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter if it's baked beans or porcupine quills, as long as the public believe that's what wealth is. And those who have control over the source of that wealth, which is generally used to be the gold and silver industry in for the Western countries in the Middle East, it doesn't matter if it's that or the printing presses, as long as they say so, then they're in charge of the wealth. Therefore, they can churn as much out as they want to hire thousands of think tanks in all areas of control. And that's the key to it, is the areas of control. And it's not difficult to look into how societies have been controlled all down through the ages, because religion stands at the top. Now, if you want to take over a world, you must take charge of all the religions at the top as well. And you take over those religions and put your own people in, or buy them off. And greed isn't restricted to any particular faith. So it's quite easy to take people over and even insert them in. And after a generation or two, you'll think that they're yours. Like the Queen of England isn't really the top. She's the kind of Pope of the Anglican Church for England. And all the way back since Henry VIII, that's when it started, when he took over that role. And she sits at the head of the Anglican Church and puts this little archbishop in on top of the rest of the public, but she's still the head of it. And so she rules in the place of God, you see. And that was always called the divine right of kings. King James I got in a bit of trouble over that because he wrote a big treatise on his right to rule, speaking for God, and how no one had the right, and how dare they, in fact, question his decisions because he spoke as God, basically. And that's not too long ago, but nothing much has really changed. If you were at the top of the world and you have command over millions and millions of people, such as the British Commonwealth, and it seems America's also roped in there because so many of the top politicians have gone on over the years to get knighted by the Queen. And that was again forbidden by the Constitution, but it doesn't matter anymore. It's kind of out the window, as we can see. And they go over to get knighted for a top honor. And even top mafia guys wanted to be knighted. You find the Bronfmans, old Sam Bronfman, that ran the whiskey trade and the cocaine trade during the Roaring Twenties and Prohibition. His dying wish was to be knighted by the Queen of England. An odd thing for a gangster, isn't it? Until you realize that the same group at the top run the legal world for the public to see. And when they can't use that system because the public would complain, they use the underground, the underworld, you see, to do it for them. That's how it works. But getting back to theosophy that was created mainly for women to get them in to the occult organizations, and they wanted really a middle class and the upper middle class to come in and get them on board, as you say, which pirates love. Then you find that Annie Besant took over from Blavatsky. And so you had an HB for Helena Blavatsky, and then you had an AB for Annie Besant, and she was followed by another AB, which was Alice Bailey. But you go back to Besant. Now, why on earth would you have a name like Besant? Names are very important for front people, because Besant was the name the Knights Templar gave to their flag, you see. That's why. And her father was a Lord Bruce Besant in the British House of Lords. Again, aristocracy was in charge of the setting up of that movement to get them in. And sure enough, the women went into it and thought they were being told secrets, but then were told what the great work was for them, at least. And that was, again, to encourage missionary work across the world, not going themselves, mind you, but to encourage others to do it, you know, the lower middle class, to go off abroad and suffer the hardships and convert all these poor pagans that just needed God's help so that the British could steal their land and property and all their wealth. And that's what they did for a couple of centuries. So you find that money rules, as they say. Money rules everything, only because the public accept it as a substitute for something or other. In other words, real wealth. And that's why they call real estate the only real estate. That's why it's called real estate. Everything else is fake, you see. And even your real estate isn't yours, your property, because if you look at even your titles to your deed, you'll find really that you don't own it at all, and it's registered. Anything that's registered under law is not yours anymore. You're simply in possession of it. So we're conned and conned and conned all down this long, dusty road. And going back to the Royal Institute of International Affairs, they have publicly taken the credit for pushing and putting the bills forward for the income tax and property tax quite some time ago. They were the ones who did it. The CFR branch did the same thing in the United States. So they've been running this world as a sort of front organization for this aristocracy, this very old aristocracy that's run the world for a long, long time, that actually uses for its symbols all the symbols of Egypt even. And that's an odd thing to say, but it's true, because the coronation of the queen can show you sitting on a raised dais or a ziggurat-type pyramid, a stepped pyramid, in the throne, wearing your crown and holding the little scepter, which is the world, and the little wand thing in her hand, which is actually a little flail. And you'll see the same thing in ancient pharaohs as well. And you'll see it on the hieroglyphs even depicting Nimrod thousands of years ago, and there it has been performed in Britain in places like Westminster Abbey. And you find the floor of Westminster Abbey is a checkerboard floor, the black and white squares, which is also the tesserated floor of the Masonic Lodge. And in Westminster Abbey too, if you walk around there and look at all these knights, they're putting little little sarcophagi, just like the tombs of Egypt. And on one wall, they have one for a very wealthy old family from Norman descent, and they have two Egyptian obelisks on the ground floor, and just halfway up the wall is another two there, very obvious Egyptian obelisks in a supposedly Christian church from the Middle Ages. And people go through that and never ever question why, because we're not taught to think or reason, we're taught to parrot what we're told. And that gets me back to my original point here. The sudden shock of waking up and realizing that things are not the way it's been downloaded into your mind to be. Things are vastly different. Today we see the velvet glove being taken off the iron fist, which is showing itself and is glistening rather brightly in all countries under this Terrorism Act. Britain has now declared itself to be, in the newspapers, Fortress Britain. They copied that from the one that was in the Canadian papers from 2005, when the Prime Minister of Canada signed an agreement with Mexico and Canada to basically integrate the first open part that was given to the public on national television for the integration of the Americas, security forces, taxation systems, customs duties, all that was integrated. And they had to make another five agreements up until 2010. And by then, the complete unification of at least the US, Canada, and Mexico, and perhaps even Chile, was to be completed and up and running. And before that, they even discussed putting a new capital for the Americas, a new Brussels, just like Europe's got, and base it in Montreal, Canada. Why Montreal? Because it's under the Napoleonic Code, which was rather likely on the banking system, and that's where they'll be based. So we're going through a script. That's the bottom line. We live a script, and people have a hard time figuring that out. I'll be back after the following messages. I'm Alan Watt, back with Cutting Through the Matrix. Just giving you a little bit, because there's so much you could give out, but it would take forever. Showing you how nothing has been left, no stone has been left unturned to bring about a totally controlled society. Now, in ancient times, even in Egypt, who left more records than most nations about their method of control, they simply dominated the public by giving them a particular religion with the Eye of Ra. And you couldn't go anywhere in Egypt without seeing a symbol of the Eye of Ra. And in other words, this eye was watching you and knew your thoughts, you see, could see inside your mind, and you had to behave yourself. And even the slaves were trained that this eye, no matter where they ran off to, they get found. And so they were the best behaved slave that ever existed. They found the same technique with tyrants down through history, and even Stalin had his picture everywhere, just like George Orwell showed in his 1984 black and white movie made in 1984 by a British company with Richard Burton in the movie. And wherever you went, even up your stairwell, you'd see pictures of the tyrant who was watching you, this fatherly figure, this stern fatherly figure. And that was meant to implant itself in your mind that there was nothing that you did that wasn't known. So that's the key to it all. If you can either make people believe religion and keep them very ignorant, and the masses in all ages, remember, couldn't even read and write. We were only given reading and writing for the majority of the public so that we'd be efficient in industry. You can't very well make things in factories if you can't follow instructions and read blueprints, so they had to give a basic education. But they also withheld archives of history, the true archives of history. All you got at school was dates, times, battles, and winners. That's what you got. You weren't given the primary motivating forces behind it all and who benefited from it and who funded it. And that's the main thing. Who funds all these wars? You'll find that you pay for it all, but you seldom find, really, except maybe 100 years after the event, who actually funded it and profited it from in the first place. And by the way, why isn't there a world court to try these characters for crimes against humanity, all these big bankers that fund the wars? I mean, wouldn't that be a start in the right direction? Because without their funding, you see, we wouldn't have the wars. That's too obvious. That'll never happen. And that has been run down through the ages. So Joe Blow is waking up today and he's freaking out because he says, my God, this system that I thought was mine is vanishing. And I see all these armored vehicles around big cities and so on. And now they're going to go into searching people in shopping malls. As you walk into the shopping mall, the shopping plaza, they want to do body searches there now. Because now you've had a few years of seeing these black-clad goons with machine guns walking around in these shopping malls and subway stations. Well, now they want to search everybody coming in and out. You see? Training you Pavlovian style, step by step. And that's how they do it with animals. All those animal things that you watched on television and experiment with animals, it was nothing to do with the animal behavior control. It was all to be used on you. And once you become familiar with something in your environment, that's the key to it. That's what Singer talked about in behaviorism, the psychology of behaviorism, and how to control millions of people. You alter the person's behavior by altering their environment. Once you accept a foreign object in your environment, and a guy with a black uniform on and a machine gun is definitely a foreign object in your environment, then the next step is to get you padded down, and you'll accept that. So it's always a step-by-step-by-step process of acceptance in this Pavlovian style, because we're going into an era where the changes they're making are so contrary to everything that you thought was normal, even though normal was given to you as well, because normal keeps changing. It's so contrary to it that, again, it seems an alien to you, completely alien, all of this kind of behavior. Plus, even bringing in the DNA testing on babies and such like that, which is going on in Michigan or Illinois and other places. This is the whole eugenics system being pushed into play step by step. And eventually, and not too long from now, what's left of marriage will be forbidden except for a little while amongst people who are allowed to marry for certain offspring's purposes only. That will be the thing. And then eventually we'll go into the enhanced humans, and there'll be two classes of human beings. This has all been written about and published in the mainstream. And unfortunately, people only believe the mainstream, but they have published that with two classes of people, the genetically enhanced ones, who will be superior, and the inferior types, you know, the junk gene types. At the moment, we're all the junk gene types, all the commoners, if you don't have a title, because the elite go by the Darwinian theory, and Darwin is only a front man for those particular people. They believe that they have proven by accumulating vast amounts of wealth and power over billions of people across the world, that they have the right to rule those people, that they are superior. And even though we can classify them as psychopathic in nature, which they definitely are, they don't class themselves the same way. They see that as the natural process of nature. The top predators have the right to dominate the weaker ones. That's what they believe. And we're going through this new, brave new world scenario. And this 100 years war, and that's what it was called by Rumsfeld himself, this 100 years war. Obviously, it's not going to take 100 years to alter the Middle East. We know that. We know that for a fact. So they're talking about the whole world system and bringing in this new scientific type of dictatorship where technocrats and scientists will dominate the process of the future and the kind of world you're going to get brought up in. And there'll also be a world run by experts. It pretty well is already. It's a world run by experts. And that's what Lord Bertrand Russell wrote about back in the 1920s and then again in the 50s with his book, The Impact of Science on Society. He said, we shall create a world where the average person will be unable to think for themselves. We shall give them experts for everything. And he was talking about using the media, television and radio primarily, until you grow up, one generation grows up with that. And sure enough, they can't go outside without listening to the weatherman to tell them what to put on and what to wear that day. That's how bad it's become. The example Russell gave was that a mother would be unable to change the diaper on her own child without professional instruction from an expert. And here we are. We've been here for millions of years, supposedly, and women had no problem with that in the past, but today, they don't know. They don't know. And they have no confidence because an expert must tell you what to do. And that's already happened. And it's happened with pretty well every facet of our lives. Now, at the top of this multifarious octopus with even more legs going off it than the octopus's eight, going into thousands and thousands of branches, they also gave you the self-help groups. And vast amounts of bookshelf space has been given in all your public libraries and in all of your mainstream bookstores for self-help books. It's incredible how many there are out there. For every problem, there's dozens of often conflicting self-help books, because all of this was to get you into a form of throwing out your old crutches, which generally was religion, you see, for people, and accepting scientific crutches, because the scientific ones, they use a bit of psychobabble to hook you. We'll take over, the white-coated priests take over from the black-coated priests, and you think they're professional and scientific, so you follow their advice. And that's created incredible chaos throughout society, especially amongst families. And people actually read these books, and then they go out and start arguing with their mate or someone else, where they say, well, you've been oppressing me all my life. It says so in this book here, see? And I've got to do this about it. This has been happening. These were all put out by the different legs of this big octopus, this Royal Institute for International Affairs, that's in league with all the other foundations, especially the scientific foundations and all data gathering foundations, because knowledge is power. And those who have ultimate knowledge have ultimate power over all the rest. And this is how the world really is run. It's an integrated system of power that interrelates and interlocks with each other. And they have annual meetings with specific parts of their functions going together, like the Bilderberger Group, where royal families and big bankers and up-and-coming prime ministers or presidents are brought in. And that's where they select the presidents, in fact, before you ever hear their names. Back after the following messages. Hi, folks. I'm Alan Watt, back with Cutting Through the Matrix, and trying to dispel some of the modern myths that are being put out there, again, heavily funded, to confuse people and keep them going in circles. And by that, I mean also the whole New Age movement, which was started and promoted out of London once again. That they were the ones who started the whole idea of mediumship, or channeling, as they called it then. And that flourished through people like Madame Blavatsky, and through a lot of the women's circles, the upper middle classes and so on, as they had little tea meetings, tea and crumpets, as they called it. And they'd invite in the local channeler, who would give them what everyone really wants in that whole movement, regardless of the type that they go into. They want a form of assurance that for them personally, the world's going to be okay, and the future is going to be just nice and hunky-dory, regardless of what's happening to anyone else. That's really what all these characters prey on. They prey on the fears of the individual. And sometimes, sure, they'll tell you you'll meet someone tall, dark, and handsome. And that's no lie, because in your life, you have no doubt you'll meet them here and there. It doesn't mean anything is going to happen, but you'll meet them. But people are really after assurance, which is a form of insurance that they're going to be all right. In the old days, you just pay priests for that thing. They'd pray to their deity, and you'd be blessed, and you felt protected. And the more afraid you were, and the more money you had, you could feel much, much better after parting with your money and having all these prayers said for you. You had special protection. And it's much the same. The more they pay to the sharks out there for their well-being in the future, the better they feel. They must live in this delusion, not just illusion, but delusion, that somehow forces are going to take care of them personally as the world goes to hell in a handbasket. And other ones use different techniques too. Pictures, which are, as Carl Jung called them, he said they're archetypal images. And you'll find that on various symbols and in cards and so on. And they use that too to give you readings and soak the money out of you, and give you that good news and maybe a little cautious news, just to make it sound more real. And they fleece you, because you're the sheep, you see, and that's what you do with sheep. You fleece the sheep, and they're all mutts. They're mutton, you see. That's the function of a sheep. And the good shepherds that come out from the top to lead the people who have have no faith in themselves, love to follow the good shepherds. So they always get fleeced. That's the history of the world, and it's still going on today. And as I say, this whole New Age movement was designed also to bring in a new type of religion, a religion where people will be disconnected with the reality, regardless of what's happening in the world or to those around them. They live in their own little world, and the wave of their hands to bring down the moon and Wicca and all this kind of stuff, and feel very, very nice as people across the world are being blown to bits by their tax money in the forms of bombs and cluster bombs, etc. So they're oblivious to what's happening in politics. They don't want to know. And that's how you disarm people. You disarm their minds first. And that's mainly what the New Age has been very, very successful in doing. A New Ager is like someone standing on the tracks of a train, and the train is coming up behind them, and they don't want to even turn around and look at it. They don't want to see it. They don't want the bad news. And they'll tell you that, I don't want to know. That's negative. Well, here's the other part of the bad news. You see, if you don't look at what's negative, then you're losing your survival capabilities. That's why you have these capabilities. The little warnings that go off in your mind are for self-preservation. And you're out the running if you can't look around and see that train coming up behind you. So you've been neutralized by a very effective method. And also we find that MI5 and 6 have been behind it, also creating these myths for the public. Who would have thought that your spy agencies were involved so heavily in the creation of essentially new religions and mass movements and leading them to? Because old Aleister Crowley, we find out later, in declassified documentation, the man who was set out back in the 20s, right through the 30s and 40s, etc., this man started up the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis, a branch of Freemasonry with 96 degrees, mainly to get the young, up-and-coming, budding artists that we led, who would be leading the sheep again, the people, in the near future. And sure enough, in the pop, rock, and entertainment world, that was our hero, Aleister Crowley, and the OTO. So many people at the top were members of that. It staggers imagination how they all fell for it. But Crowley was actually trained and put out by MI6, in fact. He even was a spy in Germany for them for a while. So once again, even your secret services are involved in the creation of modern mythologies. So I always caution people to beware and use their own judgment and don't follow anybody, including me. Check everything I say out for yourselves and don't take anything for granted. And I try to stick to the documentation that the big boys themselves have published. Books about the big boys are often slanted in so many different ways, depending upon the author's intents, that it can be very misleading. And you don't have to read about them by other people. Read the books that they put out themselves. Read all the books you can get by Lord Bertrand Russell. And you'll find in the foundations, once again, they set up foundations. There's even the H.G. Wells Foundation, another propagandist for this particular elite. You'll find there are books there for $500 and more. Those are the ones they obviously don't want the public to get. The other ones you can get for maybe $40 or under. But the other ones, the ones where they spoke to their own peer group, their equals, generally are priced out of the range of most people. But look into Bertrand Russell's books, for instance. He certainly was a proponent for this new world order where the inferior gene types, all the useless eaters, as he called them himself, should simply be eliminated, because to bring them all into a new world order would maybe bring down that new world order during its birth pangs. It's an odd philosophy, because if you look at the philosophy of Hinduism, it's the same. It's the same philosophy. Because in Hinduism, and here's Darwin's whole theory, you start off really as sort of slime, and you move from there as amoebas, and just go up the ladder through evolution. And you compare that to Darwin's theory, which he didn't write himself because his grandpa had put it out before him, but it flopped, and it made Darwin a superstar by a build-up in the media, and his book was a bestseller before it even hit the shelves. That's how you create a star. It's no different today. So he rehashed his grandpa's writings, which was just the inner beliefs of an upper elite who already ruled Britain and other parts of the world. Today they simply call them junk genes. Now, junk genes being the commoners. And they actually set up eugenics societies. Now, the Rockefeller Foundation in the United States started up the American Eugenics Society, and they published their own magazine every month with pictures of these lovely white people with lovely teeth and nice and tall and all the rest of it, nice families, who were the perfect specimens of the superior type of breeding. And that's how blatant they were not so long ago. Now, they were also the guys behind the funding, Rockefeller and others, of IG Farben, that set up the Nazi industry for World War II for Germany. And that's where they also got it. Adolf Hitler got all his ideas from Darwin in genetics, basically, in superior types and inferior types. He also was a great believer in Blavatsky. He read her books. And you find that Lenin was no different. The Soviet system, dealing with the Soviet side, which was international socialism, supposedly, versus national socialism, also believed in superior types and inferior types, Trotsky more so than Stalin or Lenin. And Trotsky came out with the idea of perpetual revolution. That's why he had to flee the Soviet system. He wanted the revolution to go on to the next step and the next step, in the belief that they could speed up the process of evolution scientifically and kill off the inferior types at the same time, generation by generation, eliminate them. These are the people in the history books. The people today still follow. They still follow their beliefs. And if you look into the guy who trained your various leaders in the U.S., like Rumsfeld, you'll find it goes back to a particular professor that was sent over from Nazi Germany, who also was a Nazi, but also believed in the Trotsky idea of perpetual revolution to evolve man through man-made impetus, speed up the process, and bring him to this final Superman. And here we are going through it now today, folks. I'll be back after the following messages.